Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. This is Jason Henricks. Excited in this first half to bring you another episode of the Augmented Advisor, chatting with Dan Egan from Betterment. Dan has spearheaded a lot of the product, and especially the behavioral economics that Betterment incorporates into their robo-advisor. And today we're talking about how design and user experience really impacts outcomes and how important that is to help shape the best possible, not just experience, but the outcome for the consumers. Now, the Augmented Advisor series is brought to you by Blueleaf. Access to high-quality financial advice is a global challenge and is a significant contributor to the wealth gap. Blueleaf helps financial advisors serve clients of all sizes by decreasing the time and cost to service a client. Providing high-touch service to smaller clients is not only possible, it's profitable. The combination of machine learning, sophisticated automation, and beautiful, simple design in client communications and reporting, as well as back office functions like rebalancing, trading, and billing, eliminates most of the incremental costs of a new client or better service for your existing client. Visit blueleaf.com to learn more. And then in the second half, JP chats with Greg Palmer of Finovate and the Finovate podcast, which you can find at provoke.fm. And you might have noticed 2020 was a bit topsy-turvy, not just for the startup world, but for the world that most of us attend, like the Finovate conference. And Greg talks about what is next in the world of fintech and Finovate, and get an exclusive peek into what's next for the Finovate podcast exclusively at provoke.fm or wherever you find your podcasts. Dan, I remember the moment I fell in love with Betterment, other than, like, you know, falling in love with the team. But, you know, for me, and you know, for history, like, you know, this goes back a decade now. Like, it was really bold and different, but it really came back to the whole idea of risk, right? And understanding your risk and the way you visualize it, rather than a survey where I, like, filled in a bunch of things. It's like, of course, I'd rather have more money than less money. And, like, I consider myself risk averse, but the ability to actually, you know, contextualize that. And I still remember, like, plain as day, like, the aha moment when I saw that, in terms of, like, the, would I rather, you know, have the potential upside of this or the downside of that, and how it plays out over the course of, like, what that 10 years would look like. I'd love to know, like, that moment of inspiration, like, how did that, as, like, a point in terms of, like, why was that the first problem to go be solved?
Great question. I think one of the big things, I can't take credit for this. This was something that John Stein set up from the very, very beginning. I think there's a strong underlying principle of show, don't tell in it. You know, like, it's not a matter of kind of, like, coming from on high as an expert and saying, here's the way things should be, but rather showing people and making it self-evident and allowing them to play around with it. That interactivity was actually one of the key advantages we saw with the technology, where we say, you know, like, people should be able to visualize and see the trade-offs of, like, you can take on more risk, and here's what the upside to that will be, and here's what the downside will that to be. Over the term that you're investing, we have the technology now, we can do these things. So one was just that's element of almost empowering people to have the right mental models to be able to see how things change in real time as they play with them. And not telling them, not sort of saying, well, you're a risk level 5, so therefore you should have this kind of portfolio. One of the really great things about it that comes back to me is, like, people are able to take that and integrate it and think about it differently. So I don't think that, like, a person has one specific risk profile. They might have a very conservative risk profile for this specific goal. And by seeing, like, how risk plays a role in, like, the chance that they're going to achieve their house down payment versus their, I want to buy a Tesla in 5 years, they actually get to trade off how much they have to save, how much risk they're going to take. And internalize those decisions and feel like they had agency in them rather than somebody else just telling them what to do.
Well, and I think that's an important point that often is overlooked, was that goal-based feature of it, that not, the goal is not just the carrot, but as you just described, I have different tolerances. Like, it, if I don't buy my Tesla because, like, that didn't happen fast enough, yeah, like, I'm probably going to be okay. But if I'm not able to retire, like that is probably less okay.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of my tolerance there.
One of the really important aspects to it, though, is how it allows you to, I sort of sometimes say, be conservative to be aggressive. So if you are a customer who comes in, and one of the things that we do recommend early on is set up an emergency fund, a safety net goal, yep, so that you know you've got your six to 9 months of unemployment covered. And that safety net means that you are no longer worried about your portfolio in retirement. You get to sort of segregate those risks and say, this is the safe one, this is the risky one. And we see over and over again, the people who actually have a safety net are able to take on significantly more risk, both in their investment portfolio for retirement, but also in their career. They say, well, I can risk it. You know, like I can do the risky thing here because I've got the safe thing here.
Well, intellectually, I hear what you're saying. When part of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is, Betterman was one of the first that I know that really put such high emphasis on this behavioral economics, because intellectually I understand what you're saying and it totally makes sense. And I think most listeners of Breaking Banks would shake their head and say, yes, like totally, like, of course you should be doing that. I might've been bifurcating that risk already in my spreadsheets and intellectually, but people don't tend to make really good logical decisions like you were just describing. And so I'm interested in terms of choice structuring and the tools you began to build into Betterment to help people understand that.
Yeah, I think one of the ways is just very simple. It's like make good decisions easy. You know, like put a little bit of friction in for people when they're going to make a mistake, make sure they're informed about it, but also make it super easy for them to make the right or the better decision. And so sometimes it's actually about a lot of people don't generally like to make decisions. They're a bit onerous. You know, we've all got jobs. We all got stuff we have to do. So that those two things coincide with like, let's try and take as much as possible of the math, the trade-offs off of their plate and give them to them as like a menu, a choice that they can decide from. So really good example is people sort of getting worried about the market. Is it going to go down? It's been going up for years. It's been this incredible bull market.
Yeah, like this impending, like what goes up must come down. Like
must, absolutely, yeah. And I think, you know, like one of the things I've been talking about a lot lately is the contrast between brokers and advisors, right? So a broker gets paid if you trade, regardless of your trades are good or bad, regardless of your account goes up or down, et cetera. They just want you, you know, like holding cash, trading, whatever it is. And one of the things that you don't realize if you go to sell out after the market has been going up, if you're in a taxable account, you're going to owe capital gains taxes.
Yep.
They might be long-term if you're lucky. They might be short-term if you're not. A lot of the default lot selection that is on brokerages tends to do first in, first out, which means you're probably going to be selling the lot that has the highest embedded gain in it, which is not smart from a tax point of view. Yep. So one of the things that we started doing early on is that, you know, when you come in, you say like, you know, give me $500. Number one, we do a lot selection that minimizes the amount of tax that you're going to have to pay. So you don't even have to be like, oh, please minimize taxes for me. Like, you know, of course we're going to do that. You're going to try and pick whichever shares are going to cause the smallest tax bill. Yeah. But number two, even given that, you know, markets go up. So we calculated in real time the capital gains you were going to be realizing and what that translates to in terms of taxes. And this is something that people just don't think about. It is not the top of your mind when you're kind of like, oh no, market might go down. I'm worried. Let me change my allocation. And putting that information up in directly in front of people when they're making an allocation change and saying, you know, you're going to owe $100 worth of taxes if you go through this because of this specific individual change. Informed them about something that wasn't top of mind for them, injected a little bit of friction that made them think about the trade-offs of what they were doing. And we generally see that those allocation changes, 9 out of 10 times people don't go through with it because they go, oh, it's going to cost me in taxes. I'm not actually that certain this is the right thing. And I know I'm going to pay the $100 in taxes. So I'll back off and let it ride for a little while longer. So I do think that there's one of the critical things is sort of like, I want that baked into the design rather than having it to be effortful for the user.
That is such an interesting application of, you know, we often think of user interface and user experience as taking friction out, but actually inserting friction, you know, to kind of move them in the right way, right? You know, I think back to the original Thaler and Nudge about, you know, if you have the vegetables at the front of the line, you know, for school, you're more likely to fill up your plate with those. It's that same kind of friction, but applied to your financial life. I'm curious, are there other places that you look at that you say, you know, these are the good frictions that it, even if you're not using a robo advisor or, you know, these other things, where should you have friction in your life? And where should, where those places you look at, here's absolutely a place we need to go take friction out.
Yeah. One of them that I think people don't appreciate is actually two-factor authentication. As a, you know, like it makes it more secure. That's very good unto itself. It also makes you be like, okay, I have to have these two things coincide in order for it to happen. I have to both log into my account and I have to have my phone right beside me in order to be able to do something. Yeah. And I love the idea there of also, you know, it might just be you, but it's you on a different device in a different setting saying, yes, I also approve of this thing. So be it a large, I was reading a wonderful piece of design research that was speculative about what a bank could do for customers who, for example, have a problem staying up late at night and spending money on the internet. And saying, you know, like, maybe what we need to do here is let people do it, save those transactions and don't process them until the next morning. And the next morning say, hey, do you still want to spend $200 on this stuffed animal? You can do it. It's perfectly fine. We just wanted to insert a little cooling off period because we know that you sometimes regret the spending that you do late at night. So I think there's a lot of, I don't want to kind of like give away any secrets or anything. There's a lot of very intelligent design, which doesn't necessarily like shove somebody, stop them cold. You know, I do think that there are good hot stops, like guns have safeties for a reason. So do a lot of power tools. It's very easy to do a lot of harm very quickly, unintentionally, unless you like, you need to be deliberate about how you're going to interact with this thing. So I think those things, safeties and guardrails, are very helpful. You can still use the tool. You're just not going to accidentally hurt yourself using it.
You know, it reminds me, and I don't even know if it exists anymore, but there was that texting app that after a certain hour, you like had to enter math problems.
Yes, right? Google Goggles.
Is that what it's called? Was goggles, right? So that you didn't, you know, do the drunk texting, you know, to the ex, right? It's, you know, the equivalent of like those guardrails. Similar vein on the, you know, thing, not just the guardrails and the safeties, but the things that you looked at and said, here's what we needed to go at and to take the friction out. What's the next horizon of friction? Not just like where it's happened so far, but you know, the combination of AI and digitization and the interaccessibility of platforms, like what's the future of where friction goes? And not expecting you to give away, you know, the secrets, but what does the future hold in terms of taking that friction out?
A couple of things I throw out there. One is the sort of knowledge about the future and how we can learn from each other. So one of the biggest impediments a lot of people have to setting up a financial plan is, you know, you come in and you're like, okay, I'm ready to start saving and investing. And we might ask you, what are your goals? And you're like, I just want to make more money. That's my only goal. And the answer to some degree is like, I don't know. You're 27 and you recently got married and you're currently renting. I'm going to put money on that. Your goals might be house down payment, start saving up for kids, because the first 4 years that you have kids, the daycare expenses are going to knock you for a loop.
Oh yeah.
And learning those things. Like I think one of the things that's tough is, you don't know what is next in your life unless you sort of actively put effort into learning from people who are 5, 10, 15 years ahead of you and what they wish they could have done back when they were your age. So almost intergenerationally saying, us going out to like Betterment clients who are in their 60s and saying, we want to hear from you. What should you have done in your mid-20s, in your mid-30s, in your mid-40s, et cetera? So that when we're saying like, you know, people come in and they're like, what are your goals? We actually have a menu, a sort of a scaffold for them to grasp onto and say, most people in your situation are going to want to have these goals that they start planning for, even if they don't know that they need them yet, because they're things that pop up unexpectedly and quick and can cost you a lot of money if you don't prep for them. So one is that. One is kind of like a generic learning from others to have better plans in the future that we don't think about. Another is more sort of like what I think of as liquidity management, cash management in some ways. One of the things we love seeing at Betterment is people withdrawing their money because they have achieved their goal. So a great example is buying a new car, right? They save up for 2 or 3 years. They then have $30,000 in the account. Boom, they buy a car, no financing. They're very happy with it. Now, sometimes We see that they have to sell taxable gains. There's a big cost to it. They would have been better off taking, especially in a low interest environment, a short-term asset blocked loan out instead of doing that. So yeah, balancing taxes versus interest rates. At the same time, our biggest, aside from auto deposits and first-time deposits when people are joining, there's a lot of people who have, I don't know how to put it, like chunky or variable income. And these people actually make deposits every month, but they don't feel comfortable having them commit to an auto deposit. So this is where things like two-way sweep comes from, where we're like, hey, it seems like you have a really large excess of cash in your checking account. Do you want us to hold on to that? You can still access it, but we'll pay you an interest rate. So those are two sides of the same thing, that, you know, like expenditures and income don't always line up perfectly, and smoothing between them in a way that helps the client earn interest or minimize taxes. Those are things that should be easier for people, and they shouldn't have to put in a lot of effort to have done.
Interesting. So part of this, what you're talking about, you know, it was only available to the wealthy, right? Someone who had an advisor that you're not a broker who, you know, did trades for you, but someone who literally sat down and mapped out this plan for, you know, your life and knew those things. What would, you know, hey, you're this age, you should be making this decision, especially when you're younger and, you know, you're still the rising wealth. When you look at how technology and fintech in particular has impacted accessibility, have we reached our potential yet?
No, I mean, we're well on the way. I think in a funny way, one of the co-evolutions that happens is that higher net worth people see that they have to differentiate, because things like tax loss harvesting and asset location, they're perfectly well done by computers. So I think about they're kind of like being depreciating differentiation, things where the computer will be able to do it and will be able to do it at scale and at lower cost and so on. And those things is just a matter of time. I think we're probably be about like 50 or 60% of the way along the path there. There is still, so number two, that, you know, people who are getting their advantage eroded are going to continue to evolve. They don't stand still. They will find new ways, you know, like exclusive listings that they will try and differentiate from something that does work at scale. And I think that's fine. I think that's kind of like just setting up two different, very niche markets. And then there's something that I don't think is ever going to fully go away, which is the people who want to have that, I don't know how to put it, that task intermediated by another human being. And there's a lot of reasons for this. Some people just prefer talking to another person and delegating it, having them do it. Some people like having the ability to fire somebody and say, like, I didn't make a bad decision. You made a bad decision. I'll just have a little, like, you know, carousel of advisors who I use, who I get to shove the blame onto. Yeah. But I think that there will always be a market for intermediaries, for human intermediaries, for people who say, I don't want to be bothered. I just want to have somebody I can trust to do this. So I think that's a sort of persistent, non-depreciating differentiation.
Well, so along those lines, you bring up this idea of like wanting to have, you know, a human involved. And I think this is one of the things that is actively lost. And, you know, the sponsor for this, you know, the podcast is around the Augmented Advisor, this series. And this idea of, you know, do you view that robo and technology pushes the human out? Or how does the human, in like, should the human be viewing, the human advisor be viewing technology as the enemy? Or what, how does that, you know, the reason of augmentation is the name, how does that, you know, human slash technology meld happen?
I mean, I feel like we've been through this a number of times, and there's a great number of paradigms that we can look to in history, you know, like industrialization or the printing press. Like, people used to write by hand, and then they were like, oh, we can print this. It allowed for those words to reach lots of people at much lower cost. You could like scale up the distribution. It actually made authors more valuable, and being an author more value. So I think in a similar way, it could just kind of redefines where the value of an advisor is. And a lot more people are going to have access to, you know, like planning and tax planning and tax loss harvesting, all the, like all of these features that used to, if you have to employ a human being to do it, it is cost prohibitive to have everybody have it. So those sort of repeatable tasks, et cetera, they are going to become available to everybody, which means that advisors are going to have to do what I think of as like moving up the value chain, right?
Yep.
If your value add was effectively being a glorified Microsoft Excel sheet, you need to move up the value chain because the computers are going to do that now. And
that, probably do it better, just for the record, right? Fewer errors and, you know, faster, all of that.
We have a lot less idiosyncratic opinion in it, without a doubt. So I think it's unlocking. I think it's making advisors a little bit more like authors pre and post printing press, where if you are good at it, you can scale it. You can scale the specific thing that you are good at. But if you try and fight and be like, no, I've got wonderful calligraphy, you're not going to win.
My reporting is phenomenal. Look at my reporting, right? Yeah. Let me explain to you again what beta means and what alpha means.
Yeah.
So I find it very interesting, like when you say we're 15, 20% of the way there, that's actually encouraging to me that we're not, you know, further along in terms of the accessibility. And one of the things that we talk about quite a bit, though, is accessibility is not widely distributed or as distributed as it should be. I want to talk a minute about inclusivity now, because I think, you know, let's face it, so we're two white men, you know, talking about, you know, financial services. And, you know, while we see, like, you know, these micro fintechs popping up saying we are the X or Y, you know, for, you know, this group, not always widely, you know, differentiated other than like their advertising. Where do you see the role of behavioral economics and choice structuring and user interface when it comes to inclusivity?
So one of the really powerful things for me, I remember when, you know, like the robo advisor for women launched, and part of me immediately went like, what does that even mean? You know, like what are the specific things that are different where they need this entirely different thing? And very quickly became apparent that, you know, like, it's 98% the same. You just need to have different parameters for like longevity and various things. Now, very quickly, we learned that people don't necessarily want to be thought about in those categories. So you might be a woman, you might be a minority. You do not want to be served as like this thing, as belonging to this category, unless it's really beneficial to you. So much as one of the great revolutions in sort of hiring, there's the classic study about orchestra performances. They blinded it and they said, oh, actually, we hire more women if we can't see if you're a male or a woman. And we think that they do better. A lot of our clients actually prefer the fact that we don't know their gender or their race at a personal level. And they are more comfortable signing up and using us as a tool to do this because they know we don't have any way to have prejudices about them. We don't have any way to make sort of like negative assumptions about them. So one of the things is that we are kind of blind to it. And that makes people much more comfortable using us. They're not going to feel talked down to because everybody gets roughly the same interface and they can still put themselves into it by creating their own goals, et cetera. So I think one of the things that it's easy to get wrong is this idea that like I have to create it for a highly defined market as opposed to say, I'm going to create something that's very functional and effective for everybody. And I need to know about use cases that might vary across people. And that helps everybody. So this is our design team has been pushing for a while for a principle called targeted universalism, which is maybe sort of like best exemplified by the fact that, you know, cutouts on curbs and ramps are usually for people who are in a wheelchair. That's the way that we think about them. Everybody uses them. Everybody uses them. If you are walking along a street in New York City, people naturally gravitate to use the cutout. A lot of people are just going to want to walk up the ramp to go into a shop or something. So one of the things that's easy to see is like there's a group of people who benefit the most from something, but actually everybody benefits from it. Leaning into those capabilities or capacities as an app means that you help everybody. There's just an unusually big benefit for some segment of the population who like might have been the catalyst for it.
And they don't have to opt into it. That's one of the things that I took away is that, like, from that last statement is I might not want to identify as, you know, we actually had phenomenal leading advisor, you know, who you spoke about being one of the few Black people at a bulge bracket and how it changed the perspective. And he said, even, you know, other Black people didn't want me to be their advisor because of this preconception. But this idea of like that universal piece of it is I don't even have to opt into it and identify as, you know, whether, you know, be a woman or someone of like, you know, low and probably not rising wealth or currently unemployed, you know, a number of things that I don't want to identify as, but just because it's universal is the right takeaway that it actually, I don't even have to say Obi, I don't have to trade my anonymity for that, you know, unusually large benefit because it's universal. I'm just naturally going to get it.
Yes, absolutely. I think about it sometimes in terms of, I am sometimes in situations where I can't either use my hands to do something or can't look at it. You're driving and you want to send a text message to your wife. So, you know, I can verbalize it. I can say, you know, okay, smartphone, send a text message that says blah, blah, blah. And that's awesome for everybody. And it's especially good for the people who have those conditions permanent, who, you know, like can't see or whatever. So I think that level of, it is a base functionality that makes everybody better off. You just aren't necessarily sure when you're going to use it is a great way of thinking about it.
Fantastic. In more specifically, if you think about, you know, the drive towards inclusivity, I love this universal benefit. What are some of the other things that as an industry say, you know, as we drive towards really helping, whether it's the like fully marginalized or those looking for the greater inclusivity, where else should we be focused?
Oof. I think that it varies a lot by exactly kind of, you know, like the incentives of your company and where it's placed and how you have an advantage to go in and serve a specific set of people. One thing that I actually think people get backwards is starting by functionality and capacity, making things possible and putting it out there, and those groups that are going to benefit from it will find you. So it's not necessarily that you have to find them. You don't need to go out and decide, we're going to make something for group X. It's, we are going to make a capability for you to do this thing, and we're going to publicize it well enough that the people who benefit from it and need it, they're going to come and find us, and they're going to spread it amongst themselves. And that's when you get a really nice positive feedback loop of like, let's just make this possible and see what people do with it. And then the early adopters, the people who are especially interested in it, they give you the very specific, actionable feedback that you need to improve it later to make it more generally accessible.
So the act of like the over-marketing, if you will, actually masks and makes it harder to find the innovation that's buried underneath because you've got this, you know, unnatural kind of forcing function that was making it work rather than the flywheel.
Exactly. Market functionality, not, I don't know, like identity.
Yeah. So last question related to that. Of these use cases you've talked about and how your design team is thinking about it, how much of it is them having a hypothesis and going out and saying, you know, let's build and see if it takes off versus studying the what's already happening? You know, it's kind of top down versus bottom up as they think about how you begin to, you know, change and modify, you know, the behaviors, whether it's the friction or the removal of friction.
That's it's like very much a sort of question of the engineering of it. Things where Betterin has a very good sort of established culture of testing things, seeing if it works, what's the impact of it. Sometimes we even test things that we know we're going to go ahead with. We just want to be aware of and know the impact that it had on client behavior. You know, you can imagine sort of adding more disclosures to something, never made anybody quicker, but is necessary. So, another element to it, though, is that there are some things like pricing. It's impossible to sort of split test pricing because you need to tell people ahead of time, you know, here's what you're going to be paying. You need to be consistent in that. So it's always it always depends on exactly what it is that you're doing. We have a tendency to test, if only to be knowledgeable about the impact of those things and be able to learn from them in different contexts.
Fantastic. Well, Dan, thank you very much for joining. You know, Betterment has always been one of my favorites in the leading that charge on how we can make financial services more accessible. Thanks for sharing some of your wisdom on the use of behavioral economics.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Augmented Advisor Series is brought to you by Blueleaf. Access to high-quality financial advice is a global challenge and is a significant contributor to the wealth gap. Blueleaf helps financial advisors serve clients of all sizes by decreasing the time and cost to service a client. Providing high-touch service to smaller clients is not only possible, it's profitable. The combination of machine learning, sophisticated automation, and beautiful simple design in client communications and reporting, as well as back office functions like rebalancing, trading, and billing, eliminates most of the incremental costs of a new client or better servicing your existing clients. Visit Blueleaf, BLUELEAF.com to learn more.
Breaking Banks listeners, in the coming weeks, you might see some new episodes pop up in your feed wherever you listen to the show. These are some special episodes we released outside of our normal weekly Thursday schedule, and this is just a one-time update to improve how we deliver the show. Going forward, you will receive all of our weekly episodes and any special episodes as soon as they are released, no matter where you listen. Thanks for your support in making this the number one global fintech radio show and podcast.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
The Finovate podcast is your home for interesting conversations and insights from Finovate's global conference series. I'm Greg Palmer. Join me as I interview leading innovators, bankers, analysts, venture capitalists, and more to get their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Find us wherever you normally listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm.
Well, today I get to sit down again with our good friend Greg Palmer from Finovate and host of the Finovate podcast, which is part of the Provoke family of podcasts here at provoke.fm. So each week you can catch Greg and leading fintech innovators, bankers, and analysts sharing their thoughts and predictions on the future of financial technology. Greg, catch us up on what's been happening on the show, and then I want to talk about what's happening at Finovate, both virtual events and when you think we might be getting back to some physical events as well.
Yeah, thanks, JP. Pleasure to be here as always. You know, always fun to join you and talk through what's going on at Finovate. So, you know, the podcast, we've had a couple of good guests recently. The two big series that I think people would really be interested in, we've just done the best of show winner interviews with the Finovate West winners who came out at November of last year. And then it's not too long ago that we did the Finovate Fall best of show winners as well. So those are a good group to kind of hear from the companies that really wow our audiences at those two events. I would definitely recommend checking those out. And then there's a couple other good ones as well, just sort of mixed in. That's how we like to do it. We've got some good Finovate innovators on there and then some more people on the thought and content side of things. There's a good episode from Clickatell that I think is really interesting as well that I would steer people towards. But really, you know, I think, you know what to expect at Finovate. You want to hear from people who are really driving the front lines of innovation, and those best of show winner episodes are always really fun for me to do.
Well, and I think it was just about a year ago since you and I sat down and talked a lot about this. And I remember kind of two parts of our interview. One was we were both at offices, and then the next time we were talking, recording the rest of the episode, we were working from home because this was all the whole COVID thing was hitting us in February of last year. And so since then, you've had to move all of these events to virtual events. Talk about how that has worked and what you've learned through that, and where do you go next from that?
Sure. Well, I mean, obviously, it's a big undertaking, right? And I think this is one of the things that everybody experienced at least a taste of in 2020. You know, the sort of business as usual models got rocked. And I think from our standpoint at Finovate, we were really conscious of the fact that, you know, there were going to be a lot of moving pieces in the fintech space, that there were going to be some innovations that were going to come directly out of the challenges facing the financial industry as a result of the pandemic and the lockdowns and quarantines and all those pieces. And we really felt an obligation to the industry to make sure that we were able to get those stories out there and help people find technologies that would work for them. So for us, we really put a lot of thought into looking at, you know, the core of what Finovate really provides and figuring out how we could do that digitally. And so, you know, we put on a series of digital events last year. We've got a couple more all digital events coming up. Obviously, we're not out of the woods yet. But from our standpoint, we really try to focus on three big things: exposing people to new innovations that they haven't seen, helping people hear from thought leaders and experts to help guide them through these troubled times. And then, of course, giving people the ability to connect with one another, giving them that option to come together and share thoughts, which has always been such a crucial piece of what Finnovate is all about. And by prioritizing those three things, you know, we really looked at how we could deliver that in the digital setting. You know, it hasn't been easy, right? I think anybody who makes a digital pivot that quickly will tell you it's not easy. Certainly a lot of people in the banking industry will understand some of those growing pains, and there's some really similarities between how we've gone about things and what other people are doing. But I'm pretty pleased with how we, or where we ended up, and we've got a really good platform to build from now, because there are some elements of the digital events that we found that people really liked. And so the challenge for us now is, you know, how we keep those things which people enjoyed and then balance them out by bringing people back into a physical event space once it's safe to do so.
Well, you know, I always looked at Finnovate with a banker hat on, because that's where I spent so much of my career. Has this helped get more bankers who maybe couldn't travel to a Finnovate show and could now attend from their desktop? Or are you getting more from the banks attending?
Yeah, we are. And actually, the geographical reach has grown dramatically as well, because when you eliminate those barriers of people having to fly into a city like New York, which can be expensive and can obviously take you out of the office for quite a while,
yep,
we're able to make inroads into geographies that we haven't always been able to. And I think particularly when it comes to international attendees, because the content is all digital, because you can go back in and watch it at your own time, people are able to register from, you know, the exact wrong time zone and still see all the demos and still find ways to connect with their attendees, because we've left the connection portal open a lot longer as well. So I think that's the piece that we're really excited by. You know, we can reduce these barriers to entry and bring more people into the conversation with these digital passes. So I think that's been one real positive thing. I think the other one is there's a lot of people that we've discovered who just prefer to be able to be at home, be able to listen as they stay, you know, go about their business in their office or whatever else they need to do. And I think that's been something which has been kind of eye-opening for us. Now, obviously, a ton of people want to come back and do in person. There's no substitute for being in that room and seeing the big stage. But we want to make sure we're able to keep those other groups happy and keep them engaged, because it has been fun to see those groups being able to get involved when maybe they couldn't have before.
Yeah. And you mentioned the networking thing too. That seems to me that would be the hardest part to try to duplicate digitally.
Totally it is. And it's one of those situations where, you know, what people tell you they want isn't necessarily what they end up doing. And I think you see this in all walks of life, right? My wife is a school counselor, and they consistently hear from parents, kids want more socializing, they're missing their friends. They put up a networking meeting that's terrible for education, but it's basically, you know, kids networking. They arrange these things, you know, activities for kids to do, and then they don't end up showing up, because when it comes down to it, you know, actually turning on the video camera, actually clicking in, there is some barrier there that people are hesitant to break through. So, you know, we've been able to connect the people who are really motivated, though. And I think that's the good thing, because, you know, the demo videos still give you a taste. So if you see technology that you like, it is easy to reach out to those companies. We do miss the organic networking that comes from being able to just walk through a room and see somebody's name tag and stop them and say hi really quickly. But we're working on ways that we can add that in to the digital pieces as well. So I think that's something which we'll be continuing to work on. And we've actually got a new event series designed to help with people making connections in the fintech space.
How's that work?
So the new event is called Finnovate Focus. It's something which we're really excited by. And it's going to be just a monthly afternoon networking-based kind of micro digital event. At the beginning of each month, we're going to be releasing a playlist of Finnovate demos and speakers and other videos that are all centered around a specific subset of the fintech industry. So, you know, the first one we're going to do is around user experience and really just building out a digital UX that looks and feels really good. So once everybody's kind of seen the videos, we'll be bringing people in for a quick afternoon of networking, connecting. There's two main parts to it. There's a round table element where you can sit with a group and kind of talk through, share some thoughts that way. There's also like a focused speed dating piece where you'll be just matched with different people to speed network with them really quickly. All told, you're looking at about 2.5 hours of time every fourth Thursday, the day that we'll be doing it. the topic will change. And it's designed to just be a really quick and easy way for people to come in, connect with the community a little bit, and then get back to what they're doing. So it's a piece that really comes from a lot of feedback that we've gotten from attendees over the years. And digital looks like the best avenue to pull this off.
Well, you know, one downside, I guess, of Finovate is if you're really only interested in, you know, digital lending, and that's, you know, three of the 60 presenters, it is a right. lot of time and money and travel to go see those three. So this is one area where maybe digital actually has a little advantage over face-to-face events, because you can really focus then. And like you said, people can attend for, you know, that hour or a couple of hours on that Thursday, and then maybe not the next one because that's not where they're focused.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, you can do a season pass if you want to get all of them and come to see how the conversations differ from one another. But that's absolutely the idea. If you're interested in small business banking in particular, we'll have a focused topic for you on that one. If you're interested in moving money, you know, payments or remittance or things like that, we'll be doing that as a topic as well. So that's really the idea, that you can dial in on the specific subset that interests you. You can connect with other people who are interested in that specific subset. Now, of course, I always believe one of the big benefits of Finovate is coming and, you know, getting surprised by the technologies that you weren't necessarily looking for. But we do know that there are people who've been wanting, you know, I'm only interested in this one area. Can I just engage there? And digital does make that possible. This type of small digital event, I think, would be really difficult to do in person. But now that we've gotten a little more comfortable with some of the tech solutions that are out there, we feel pretty comfortable making this offer to the community and putting this product out there.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, you mentioned kind of different target areas. I mean, what are the areas that you see heating up in 2021?
So I think that's going to be really interesting to see, right? Because there will be some sort of, you know, return to normal, which, you know, who knows what that's going to end up looking like. But I think, you know, as that we get back to something that starts to feel like a new status quo, it's going to be fascinating to see what consumers end up deciding they want to do, how they want to continue to engage with their banks when they can go back into a branch and feel comfortable doing that. You know, how much of the time will they say, you know, actually, I've gotten a taste of this online banking and I really like it. I like to bank from my phone when I can. There's a reason that we're starting off Finovate focus with user experience, because we think that UX is going to be something that's going to be incredibly important for, you know, across the board within financial services here in 2021 and beyond. You know, other topics that we're looking at, I mentioned small business survival. I think this is a really crucial piece all over the world. You know, the pandemic has devastated small businesses, and that's a huge loss from a societal standpoint, from a financial services standpoint. So I expect to see people really interested in that topic as well. Beyond that, you know, I think it's going to be a lot of the same things that FinTech has been focusing on for a little bit, and continuing to look at the relationship between core banking service providers and new technologies. I expect to see a lot there. And then, of course, the value of data and how you clean up that data and you can use it to do things in artificial intelligence and things like that. I expect to see a lot more attention paid to that data side of things as a lot of the kind of front end pieces, the UX side of things, get ironed out.
Well, those are themes that aren't new. We've been talking about those, you know, for the last few years. And one of the other ones that maybe is embedded in what you were saying is a little bit of a decline in the number of apps that are trying to go direct to consumer and more that are trying to sell to the banks and credit unions, financial institutions. Are you still seeing that? And do you think that will increase or decrease or stay the same in 2021?
So I do still think that I still see that with one exception. I think the banks, the new challenger banks, which are going direct to consumer, are really the big exception there. And that's going to be just fascinating to watch, because we've seen so many of those challenger banks coming into the ecosystem. And it's obviously going to be very competitive for them. I think you look at the numbers that are entering, obviously they can't all be successful. And so right. The question is going to be, who is going to win that space? And honestly, how big of a space is that to win? Because I think that's where really good direct-to-consumer fintech has gone, from my standpoint. It's tough to get out there into, you know, as a single service that you can offer. A lot of the sort of low-hanging fruit has already been scooped up. But but a lot of really cool products do exist in challenger banks, and there's some interesting proprietary pieces there. So there is a model for direct to consumer, but I think it has to go through banks, through this kind of challenger banks or a more traditional bank in order to make headway. Obviously, the other big piece too is going to be what the big tech companies decide to do. Those companies are in a position to offer direct to consumer products in a way that, you know, a startup probably isn't. If Amazon, Apple, Facebook, et cetera, make a move here, it could be a completely different story.
Right, as Google already is. And kind of implicit to what you're saying is it's difficult to acquire those customers and it's expensive. So, you know, how much are you going to spend to acquire, you know, 1 million or 5 million new end consumers versus selling to a bank or 10 banks that already have distribution? And, you know, the reason I bring that up partially is because what you talked about earlier is how COVID did make a lot of banks kind of cross the Rubicon and do some things. And so I suspect that, you know, we might have a few more willing buyers in 2021 than we did before.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch what banks' habits become, because I think a lot of them have been forced to adopt tech solutions very quickly in many cases. And, you know, I think you could also say uncomfortably in many cases. It's been a steep learning curve for a lot of banks who hadn't really gotten too involved with technology prior to 2020. But now that they've gotten a taste of it, are they going to be in the same boat as a lot of the consumers who are going to start realizing what fintech can really do? And one of the pieces that's always kind of fascinated me is how much fintech is aimed at making banks better, making their processes easier, more efficient, improving their sales pipelines, filling their marketing funnel and things like that. You know, so much of fintech has been really geared at helping banks almost to the point where you say, well, where's the consumer fintech? You know, which solutions out there are going to be really impactful for people's lives? And now we'll see if banks start to play around with some of those tools. The ones who've been hesitant might really find some pieces that they find very exciting.
Yeah, and I think that the customer demand is kind of increasing on that. Customers who, you know, want to do. I mean, I hear anecdotal evidence of kind of the flip side of that. One of the banks we work with, a customer told them they were doing some customer research, and they said, you know, what else can we do for you? They said, open the branch. But at the same time, that bank's leadership was, hey, this is data, and we're, you know, going to pay attention to it, but we're not kind of reversing course and you know, doubling down on that. We're going to double down on the digital delivery. Well, speaking of opening up and live events, have you announced or forecast, or are you thinking about when you may return to live events at Finovate?
So our plan right now, we are targeting Finovate Fall in New York this September as our first foray back to live events. Obviously, any number of things can change between now and then. We are, just like everybody else, dependent on the success of the vaccine rollout and see what happens with new strands that might come out. But what we're hearing from healthcare professionals and experts all over the world that you know, this fall is not an unrealistic timeline. And so our goal is to be back in Midtown Manhattan in September. Of course, even though we'll be back there in person, we will still be doing our best to make the event available digitally as well. We don't want to completely give up on that side of things. So, you know, if you're in a position where you look at it and think, I'm not comfortable flying, or depending on the country that you're coming from, you might not be able to, no worries. You know, we'll still be making it available digitally too. But I'm really hoping that we can get back into the Big Apple here and resume something that looks like business as usual, even if it's not actually exactly the same.
Well, as we're recording here towards the end of January, that seems prudent from all the data that we're getting, you know, here in the U.S. and around the world, that by fall seems like a reasonable bet. So I'll certainly look forward to that. And I'm anxious to hear from our listeners, too, on what your thoughts are when you think events should open up, or when you're going to be comfortable traveling again. It's been more than a year now, almost a year. I guess I traveled last February since I've been on an airplane, and that feels weird because I'm normally on one about every other week.
But I know. Yeah, how's that first flight going to be? Aren't you a little bit nervous? Like, do you think you'll remember how to do it? Like, I think I've heard the airports are going to be completely different when we get back to them too, which is going to be fun to see also.
Yeah, no, it's going to be different, but I'm looking forward to it. And in the meantime, I'm looking forward to all the digital events and all the new innovators that are coming out with new things. Finovate Stage is always a great place to see them. And you can hear Greg and many of those innovators on the Finovate podcast, available wherever you listen to podcasts or at provoke.fm. Well, Greg, thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you at one of those soon.
Yeah, my pleasure, JP. And for anybody who's interested in joining us at any of our suites, the code BB20 stands for Breaking Banks 20 will save you 20% off any digital tickets or in-person tickets. So if you're interested in joining us, please do use that. We're happy to extend that to all of your listeners.
Excellent. Code BB20 to save 20%.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.